Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Growing Pains, the only podcast dedicated exclusively to economic development in Atlanta, Canada. And this is a very special episode, David Campbell.
Yes, it is.
We are very lucky to be able to play host to a really fun series coming from 10 regional partners called Turning Point, talking about all things post-COVID-19 and where we go from here. We just did the first webinar with Premier Higgs and Richard Sion. David, what do you think? How'd your boy do?
Richard Sion, always a pleasure to hear him speak. He's very blunt, very to the point, very matter of fact. I think you did a great job. I'd just like to put a shout out to Alex LeBlanc at the Multicultural Council who put this thing all together. He kind of likes to sit in the background, but it was his idea. You know, he put the whole thing together, organized all the partners. So he did a great job. I think Richard did a good job. I think the premier was very blunt and very open this morning and said some very, not beating around the bush like a lot of politicians. I've never heard a premier use the term 1042 lifestyle before. Mm. And for those of you living in southern New Brunswick or elsewhere, that's the idea of working 10 weeks seasonally and 42 weeks on EI. And of course, Richard knew that phrase very well and sort of picked up on it and talked about it. But, you know, and I don't know how prevalent that is. We can talk about that if you want. But it is refreshing to have a premier talk so straight about the fiscal situation, about challenges in government, and about the difficulties trying to solve some of these big intractable problems.
Yeah, I appreciated that too. He wasn't messing around. I detected optimism, but kind of a cautious optimism as we walk into this next phase, which is coming soon, we hope, but there has been a setback up north. We've had to go back into orange phase for zone 5. Hopefully that gets sorted pretty quickly. But let's dig right into it. As promised in the webinar, we have taken some of the audience Q&A that didn't make it and transported it over here. But first, to reintroduce our guest, economist and author Richard Sion. Richard, thanks for being on the podcast. Thanks for doing the webinar. It was fun to talk to you. You had a lot of good content.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Indeed. Let's very briefly cover the contents of the presentation that was covered in the webinar. We don't want the podcast to be the same, but let's do some recap on what those three main pillars of that presentation were.
Yeah, I'll try to go fast. I was trying to set the stage for the broader discussion in terms of the challenges that New Brunswick faces as in terms of the series Turning Point in the post-COVID era. What we did is that we went through New Brunswick's fiscal situation, took a snapshot, not a snapshot, but a quick assessment of the past, and then looked at the challenges moving forward. And we reviewed the three major challenges, obviously, the first one being healthcare spending, including elderly care. The second one being the issue of economic growth, generating our own source capacity, so capacity to grow our revenues. And the last one being federal transfers. So before going into that, we did a quick overview of the situation, fiscal situation in New Brunswick. And one of the things we pointed out was that very often we look at, the favorite indicator of indebtedness is debt to GDP ratio. And in actuality, and this is something that I could have expanded a bit more, but when we look at comparing New Brunswick with its sister provinces in the Maritimes, for instance, PEI and Nova Scotia, we tend to forget at times that we own a large public corporation called NB Power, which when you include all the commitments they've made in terms of refurbishing MacTaquac only to maintain the existing level of power, that when you include all of that together, we end up with a taxpayer-supported liability north of 60% of GDP, whereas in PEI, the debt-to-GDP ratio is only like 30%. So just remind people that we're in a much more difficult situation than even our neighbors. Some people will challenge this notion of using the New Brunswick NB Power debt as something that should be factored into the comparison. But frankly, when you have Standard & Poor's that says that this is not a self-sustaining entity, meaning that if it was on its own, it'd be bankrupt. When you have in Newfoundland, the province facing a liability of $8 to $9 billion related to a single asset, which is Muskrat Falls, you need to take into account the fact that this is starting to weigh. It's an albatross that's hanging around our fiscal necks, and we need to take it into account. But at the same time, people will say, well, it's the ratepayers that pay for that, and private businesses have debt too. Well, yes, but in Nova Scotia, the rates are regulated, and people do not own Emera. They've privatized it, and now it's a thriving corporation. And by the way, it's the same thing with Nalcor in Newfoundland and Labrador. Both of them privatized former utilities that are darlings in the stock market on Bay Street. But here in New Brunswick, we had this opportunity to sell it to Hydro-Québec. We didn't take it. At a time when we could have made money out of it or did well, but not anymore because the shale revolution has changed that. So anyways, all I'm saying is that it's important in order to have a comparison that takes into account our broader liabilities to remind ourselves that New Brunswick NB Power is not exactly debt-free. Mm-hmm. So the other three factors, things that we looked at were obviously, as I said, healthcare. And healthcare, the big picture there is to try to show to people that the spending is still ahead of us in terms of aging-induced pressures. All of the baby boomers are not 75 yet. And it's when you start looking at 75, 75 and beyond that it starts costing quite a bit. You know, the healthcare spending at the age of 85 is something like four times more than at the age of 65. A lot of people will talk about flattening that curve, and we should. But frankly, the reason why spending goes so high with time is that more people die. You enter into high mortality age cohorts, and the final months of life, believe it or not, are apparently extremely costly. And it's an issue we need to tackle as a nation because it has to do with, you know, some people will say therapeutic. You don't know when it's your final year of life, but in the final year of life, we spend a lot of money. And that's one of the reasons why you see that curve moving up so fast. So right now in New Brunswick, there are 65,000 people that are 75 and above. And in 20 years from now, it'll be 145,000. So that's the challenge that's ahead of us. And by the way, there's not a lot of chance that that number will be lower because at the age of 65, 70, 75, you don't move that much, you know, so that number will stay there. And if we have more immigrants, well, we'll have more people to pay for that bill, but we'll also have more people beyond the age of 75 at some point.
Richard, I was surprised how many audience questions centered around healthcare. David Campbell, should that surprise me? A lot of people have healthcare and aging on their mind in this province.
Well, it's the biggest cost right now for the provincial government. And as Richard pointed out, it's going to be a massive issue moving forward. If you double the number of people in the area, in the age group that requires the highest amount of healthcare spending, you know, by definition. So, I mean, he's got in his slide deck some of the implications of that. But I mean, you know, you could literally potentially bankrupt the province unless you find a new way to finance that, get more fiscal transfers, reduce the cost somehow, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we'll probably ask Richard a few more pointed questions on how we could do that throughout the hour.
Yeah, and there is some audience Q&A that goes back to healthcare as well. Richard, back to you.
Yeah, and on healthcare, this is the interesting part because we just don't know what the healthcare spending is going to look like. And the issue here is that I think we could deal with spending on its own, aging-induced spending on its own. It'll be quite a bit of money. It could be up to $750 million more dollars by 2030, just aging. But historically, aging has not been the major source of cost escalation. It's been wages and others like technology, drugs, and all of that. And the reason for that is because in Canada, we have 13 healthcare systems, not one. Okay, we have 10 provinces and the three territories. And historically, when there's a lot of money in the system, what happens is that people compete for scarce resources. And the way to do so is by offering better conditions, including wages. So when there was a lot of money in the system, people spent more. When there was less money, people spent less. Now, aging changes this a bit. In theory, in the years ahead, most provinces should be dirt poor. Like, we are heavily indebted. And so will Canada federally. But the question will be, what do people prefer? Lower taxes or taxes that don't grow that fast, or good healthcare services? And given the scarcity of health professionals, particularly in the nursing profession, we're already seeing health wages top ups during this crisis. We're seeing it in Quebec. We're seeing it across the country. So The big unknown is how provinces will respond and whether some provinces will tax themselves more, because not all provinces tax themselves as much as we do. So will one province or two provinces trigger the events that happened historically, whereby other provinces had no choice but to follow suit? To give you an example, 20 or 25 years ago, the wages of a doctor or physician were about 300% of the median wage. Now it's around 450%. Do you think that politicians chose to increase wages because they felt that physicians were underpaid? Probably not, eh? It's just that that was the way to win elections. You know, you had to promise more doctors. So it's a big unknown. No one really knows where we're going. But I think that we need to make sure that if some richer provinces start triggering that escalation in wages, that poorer provinces are compensated by the federal government so as to allow them to also provide good healthcare services. But we don't know about that.
Yeah, that was a very important point of your talk, Richard, this idea that federal transfers tend to track per capita. Mm-hmm. And so younger provinces that have a lot more younger people tend to get more transfers, even as the costs are centered more among the older population. So your idea of tweaking transfer payments or trying to focus on where the costs are as opposed to just the growth in the per capita, I think that's a really insightful point.
Yeah, and that's the challenge, is that we are essentially, through these transfers, it has a pervert incentives in the sense that we're providing more money to richer, younger, faster growing provinces with fewer health conditions to spend more on their healthcare so as to inflate wages and compete with us. You know, so it shouldn't be that way, okay? But it is that way at this point, and we need to be more nimble as a federation. I'm concerned that we might not progress as much as we think we should, simply because the youngest, faster growing, richest provinces are also the most populous ones, and therefore the ones with the greater electoral weight. It's not a coincidence that Alberta benefited and Ontario benefited the most from Ottawa moving to a per capita approach. They're also the ones who elected governments, you know, so to a large extent, not just Alberta, but also other provinces. The other thing that we dealt with was briefly, and this is something that both Herb and David will be discussing more in depth later on, but it's the structure of the economy in New Brunswick, where unfortunately, because of our aging population, but also productivity, which we don't talk about enough in this province, our labor productivity has gone down quite considerably. And there's two ways to create wealth: have more workers, or make sure that what workers do is worth more. And in New Brunswick, over the last decade or so, both of those engines of growth have more or less stalled. So we need to find ways to reignite private sector growth. We need to change the mix, because the job creation has been in the public sector and the private sector has been losing jobs. And it should be the other way around if we want, or at least we should grow our private sector if we want to grow our tax dollars to pay for public services. The good news is that in recent years, we at least managed to do a bit better. We have managed to stabilize the population of those aged 15 to 64. That's a key metric, because it tells you, you know, the potential labor pool. And we've managed to grow our workforce a bit. In the last 2 years, we grew our number of workers in this province. All of this related to, not all of it, but most of it related to immigration. And the fact, by the way, that we've reversed the previous trend was that when the oil patch wasn't doing well, rather than losing our people to Alberta, we were losing them to Ontario or British Columbia. Now, over the last cycles, from what I can see, we're not losing them to any province. And surprise, surprise, our challenge these days was, before COVID at least, was not to create work, but to find workers. So people were staying in New Brunswick. Another interesting tidbit is that we have retirees coming to New Brunswick. The number of people aged 50 and 55 and above coming to New Brunswick relative to the number of people leaving, much greater, about four times more. And I suspect that some people think, well, I'd love to get a nice property in Moncton near a hospital, near the coast, and pay much less than I would pay for it in Saskatoon. So this is kind of like a great opportunity for New Brunswick. And those who think that this costs money because they use the healthcare system, Let's not forget that they come in with their pensions. They've got good revenue. They've got good income. They also, because we grow our population, we get more money from federal transfers. So I see it more as a win-win than people being a drag on the economy. Okay. So through migration, we've managed to, in French, we say colmater la brèche, which is stop the leakage on the labor force front, you know? But we're going to need to do better than that in the years ahead. And I am concerned that with COVID, we're going to have a setback and we need to revert to large immigration flows as soon as possible. And we need a strategy for that. And that strategy needs to involve Ottawa. There's already cries in some provinces for even coming from business for lower immigration in the years ahead and then to ramp it up again in the future. I do hope that we have a cogent discussion on that going forward, because this has been part of our salvation while at least, you know, improving our perspectives. And I do hope that this conversation will take place. And then after that, I'm going to be brief here. Then after that, mm-hmm. we talked about federal transfers. And I know that when you talk about transfers to people in New Brunswick, very often the eyes kind of like, you know, start glazing, and it's not something that people see as, you know, something relevant to their daily lives. But actually, I view federal transfers as our silent partner, that it's part of the fundamental plumbing of New Brunswick. And that without that, we wouldn't be an attractive place where to live. So it's very important that we consider what happens to federal transfers. And if you look over the last decade, on a real adjusted basis, they haven't grown at all. So we've had to rely more on our own revenues, which were, we increased taxes. I think in the Graham government, personal income taxes were lowered, then we reverted to performer rates, and we increased the HST. Now, we can't keep raising taxes forever, so Ottawa needs to be there also. And in recent years, at least on equalization, we've had an increase in equalization. It's equalization that was the big problem, because Ontario became a recipient. And when Ontario becomes a recipient province, Ottawa gets nervous because it thinks the bill will escalate. So they capped overall payments, which we had to make room for Ontario. And Ontario at one point took 20% of equalization entitlements. So mm-hmm. we actually saw equalization decline. Now, in recent years, what we saw is equalization payment exploding. We've seen 6, 8, 9, almost 10% growth over the last 3 years. And that has allowed us in no small part to balance our books. But we're not going to get an encore. We're not going to get equalization growing at 10% annually indefinitely. So how do we adjust to that reality too? And how do we make sure that we take into account the fact now that Ottawa is going to be quite heavily into debt, and everyone is going to cry poor. All provinces are going into debt to deal with this crisis. So we're all going to want to reinvest in a seniors nursing home strategy. And I think that it's important that we do so. But Ottawa is going to start saying that it's running out of money. So it won't be able to incent us as it did before unless it raises taxes. And if it raises taxes, that's a big issue for us because we're already quite high in terms of taxes. So mm-hmm. the entire fiscal federalism agenda is going to be critical. And we were speaking with the premier today. He was saying that he's never seen premiers and the prime minister acting in unison, singing from the same songbook as ever. Crisis will do that for you. The Second World War did that to Canada. We talked about cabinet, wartime cabinets with coalitions and all of that. But if people read their history, what they will see, though, is that Winston Churchill lost right after the war. And in Canada, we had big plans for a national healthcare commission, a national healthcare system, for equalization entitlements, for all sorts of social protections. We had one conference on Reconstruction in 1945, and it all went downhill from there. So once the urgency goes down, we realize that we have a lot of money to pay back and that we all of a sudden, our interests are not all aligned anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a tough awakening. I hope that we're going to keep the spirit of collegiality, but I wouldn't bank on it. So this is going to be a very difficult environment.
Richard, can we mix in an audience question now? We have a pertinent question to equalization and federal transfers. Colleen, thank you, Colleen, for attending the webinar and listening to the show. She asks, with Alberta's economy tanking, how will that affect their input to equalization? And in parentheses, she adds, and the total amount to be distributed to have-not provinces.
Okay. Well, as you know, its equalization is paid centrally by the federal government through the government revenue fund. So Alberta doesn't have a major say in equalization entitlements. But a couple of things here. One of the reasons why equalization was growing fast in the past, like say the 2000s, was that the disparities between oil producing provinces and poor provinces like us were growing. Okay, because Alberta was doing well, so was Newfoundland and Labrador, so was Saskatchewan. Now, with an oil crisis, disparities start narrowing, which could mean at some point that our equalization entitlements could be lower. But this is a tricky situation because equalization is calculated, and I'm sorry to get technical here, but on a three-year moving average, lagged by 2 years, which means that right now, the equalization that we're getting depends on events that have happened up to 5 years ago. Okay, so it's the formula for equalization. It's a good formula, but the problem with it is that it takes a while to materialize. So people don't associate, they don't understand why they're getting a windfall all of a sudden. You know what I mean? Because it's based on past events. That's number one. And number two, our needs have not changed yet. Fiscal disparities are lower, we're going to get less money. So you know what I mean? Like it's equalization is very sensitive to disparities in economic conditions. Mm-hmm. And when the price of oil tanks like it did not that long ago, that lowers disparities among provinces. I wouldn't be surprised if Newfoundland would be on the verge of becoming an equalization recipient. We'll see. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. David, where do you want to go from here? Do we want to get into audience Q&As or some things we should address before we do that?
Sure. I mean, I have a few questions for Richard, a few specific questions for Richard, but we can intersperse those with audience questions if you'd like. I'll start by asking Richard on the revenue side of things. So you speculated about the possibility of raising HST. I'm concerned we're at or near kind of the high end in terms of our ability to tax people. I mean, obviously, you could tax people a lot more, but at some point, you become uncompetitive with other jurisdictions, or people just revolt because they're paying such high taxes. We already have 15% HST, relatively high marginal income tax rates, property tax rates, and so on. So, do you think there's room for an increase in taxes here in New Brunswick, not federal, but here in New Brunswick, to help address some of these fiscal challenges moving forward?
The short answer is probably not, given current fiscal policies in our competing provinces. Our fiscal burden is already, I think it's already 50% higher than provinces west of the Ottawa River. I don't think we can grow the fiscal burden that much locally. Problem with an HST increase, the GST increase, it would be national. Therefore, it wouldn't affect the relativities among provinces. So on the HST, it's more about people's willingness to pay more taxes and the possibility of a tax revolt. It's less on the economic side because sales taxes are less, don't alter incentives to produce as much. They have some kind of impact on a long-term prosperity, though, but not as much as income taxes. So no one wants to see more taxes, but the reality is that west of the Ottawa River, they're not taxing themselves as much as they did before. And in fact, Alberta, if they had a PST at 7 or 8%, they wouldn't have a deficit.
So another question on the revenue side, and it's always surprised me a bit that it doesn't even seem to come into the conversation, and that is, why don't we ask people to pay more? In other words, if you think about healthcare, we still have this, you know, requirement that it has to be 100% funded by government with a single payer, which in fact it's not if you look at physio and drugs and so on, but just as a concept. So if you think about long-term care as one example, when I was in government, we looked at the potential, or we just dipped the toe in the water of the potential of having people pay out of their assets for being in long-term care. And of course, that was just incredibly impossible politically. The old people wanted to leave that money to their children, and the children wanted their parents to leave that money to them. So you lost both the older voter and the younger voter and the younger voter. So we remain one of the few jurisdictions in all of North America where, as far as I know, long-term care is not means tested. In other words, if you have more money, more assets, you pay more. Now you do; they do take a, they do take a good chunk out of your public pensions to pay for that. But in terms of your assets, so I always thought that was a little strange. Although I'd certainly like to inherit whatever money my parents want to leave. But at the end of the day, if we started to see more people paying directly for some aspects of healthcare, some aspects of other public services, it might create a little more discipline on the system, or at least that's the argument that some people are making. And I don't hear any of that conversation in New Brunswick. What are your thoughts, Richard?
Well, on the getting people to pay more, I agree fully. I mean, we have more socialist countries in France, for instance, that have copay for drugs and also for that the first dollar is not immediately covered. And you could have a mechanism whereby you make sure that the poorer people, it's not an obstacle for them to access services, but that for people who have more means that you have a mechanism there. It's ideological. You know, that's the way it is in Canada. We've chosen 50 years ago that we wouldn't we would cover the first dollar for essential services. And apparently eye care, dental care, prescription drugs outside the walls of a hospital, apparently that's not essential, which is completely ridiculous. And for that part of the healthcare system, we're in the United States of America. You know, dentists can pretty much do what they want. And so we're a bit hypocritical when it comes to healthcare. And the fact that we haven't been able as a country to even discuss this rationally over 50 years, even more now, that was 10 years ago, almost 50 years, speaks a lot about the fact that the healthcare system has the status of a sacred cow. And that's extremely dangerous because the moment that you can't speak rationally about 38 to 40% of your spending, the moment that you're in quite a bit of trouble. So it's time for that kind of a conversation, whether we're going to have it when the median voter in New Brunswick is chronologically the median voter is 53, but the effective median voter is 58. What I mean by that is that the voting age is 18. So the median in terms of the chronologically, it's about 53. But we know that older people vote more than younger people. So the median age for voters is 58. And it's gone up by 5 years over the last decade. So as we grow older and we pay less taxes when we're on old age security and on a lower income, what do you think is your calculus? More money for healthcare or higher taxes? A lot of people will say, well, higher taxes, I don't see it. So yes, of course, it's not that we want more money for healthcare. We just want good healthcare. But the way to achieve it very often is by spending more. We've been used to this idea of things being free for so long that now we can't contemplate a different world that could perhaps be better. So, David, I don't know, but my sense is that although this needs to be part of the equation, I don't hold too much hope that it will be. I don't know how you feel about that.
But guys, this is a great forum for this kind of conversation because we can hash out these topics and have a longer form discussion. It could be why that there's that much interest from the audience in the healthcare piece specifically. So I'll give you an example. In early 2020, I spent 10 days on the cardiac care ward in my city center, which is a ridiculous statement from a 28-year-old, but nonetheless, it happened. And my total cost for that entire experience, I never had a roommate. Service was 10 out of 10. My cardiologist is unbelievable. Shout out to Dr. Buick. And my costs were $11.89 for my prescription that I picked up when I got out of the hospital. As a layman, and that's the beautiful thing about a podcast is we can talk to everybody. As a layman, how would you describe that experience to them? Who picked up the bill and why did I pay nothing?
Well, I'm not entirely sure you should have paid much for that. This was essential, from what I can gather. It's more about some of the routine material and a big procedure, like what they say. What's the expression that they use? It's anyways, it's something that involves a lot of money being spent. I'm fine with this being, because it's not a regular occurrence, it's not part of the normal routine material, but just a normal visit to the doctor, just to be sent a bill. And also, if you have the means to be, you know, to pay, to co-pay, it's a way to start getting people to start thinking about how the system works. And also for the stuff that is not absolutely necessary to get the market mechanism to work a bit more. But not, this is just the idea of starting that conversation that I think is important.
So I'd like to jump in on the revenue side, because you said something about how people don't see that they're paying the taxes, or they think that other people pay the taxes. And that is a common misconception, that only rich people pay taxes. And they, in fact, in terms of income taxes, if you look at the share, you know, if the folks, let's say, earn over $100,000 a year, certainly pay a lot more in income taxes than other folks. But it's not the same if you look at HST, gasoline tax, licenses and fees, property taxes. Those are not, property taxes are a little different, but those are not based on your income. Now, they're proportionally, right? They don't graduate depending on your income. You don't pay more HST as a share of your purchase if you're rich than if you're poor. So in fact, if you look at the numbers for the provincial government, they get, you know, almost as much money from HST as they do from personal income tax. So I think the reality is the average New Brunswicker, no matter where they are on the income, with some exceptions, but for the most part, no matter where they are on the income scale, most households pay a fairly significant amount of their household income in taxes. So I don't think this is just a message for the rich. I think it's a conversation for everybody. And that is, how much is enough, right? Before we start to say, maybe we shouldn't be spending 30-35% of our income on taxes. Now, for very rich households, they may be spending 50% of their household income on taxes, or even higher, depending on their ability to avoid some taxes through investments and so on. But I just think this is part of the problem, is that people don't connect the dots between the taxes they pay and the services they get. And if they had a better understanding of that, they might be more open to different solutions, such as co-pay, or, you know, sort of trying to enforce a little more rigor on the system itself.
And there's another point about the rationality of the voters, is that in countries that are highly taxed, such as Denmark, you're going to see that people accept their high levels of taxation because they feel that they're getting their money's worth. So maybe in a sense here, part of the challenge for governments is to demonstrate value. And very often, the voter may have a different perspective about where the money should go relative to where it is actually going. Now, I'm not claiming that this is a fact or this is a reality, but I'm just saying that in some countries, levels of taxations are much higher, and they're still fine with that because they feel that it generates a society that is inclusive, that is prosperous, that is at the same time a good place where to live. Now, in some other countries, they don't feel the same about taxes. So it is obviously a matter of what do you want as a society and what should be the role of government in that society. But in order to be able to have that conversation, you need to make sure that some parts of what government provides is not a sacred cow. We need to be able to have the conversation.
Richard, two more questions from the audience and then we'll leave healthcare. Nicholas, thank you for listening. Regarding the healthcare industry, will the Nursing Association change their mind on making it easier for nurses from abroad to come and work here like they do in Quebec?
I certainly hope so, and I certainly hope that we will move forward really fast on this. But there are limits through which, in my view, we can fill the gap, so-called gap, through immigration and people moving into this province. The reason for that is that the entire Western world is aging quite fast, and there's demand for nurses around the world. A more promising avenue, in my mind, is to generate more spaces in universities and get international students from year one to study in New Brunswick. And a lot of these people, when they graduate with a job offer for $65,000, $70,000, they will jump on it immediately and stay in New Brunswick and have their families here.
David, you're nodding.
Vigorously. I think we absolutely have to have a lot more international students. And when we talk about the PSC on the turning point, webinar that we do on post-secondary education, you'll see there's been a significant decline in enrollments in PSE in recent years. So yeah, I totally agree. It's better to put them through the system and then they graduate with Canadian credentials. They go right into the workforce that way, as opposed to trying to, you know, figure out how to get the qualifications they earned somewhere else to work here.
Richard, one more question on healthcare from Reem. Hello, Reem. How can we flatten the curve of health spending without jeopardizing the quality of the healthcare service?
That's the whole point of flattening the curve sustainably. Again, we had this conversation earlier on. The big driver of healthcare costs is not aging as much as competition among provinces. And I'm hopeful that the fact that we're all in trouble to a big extent will subdue that pressure for healthcare competition. But in the end, it's about producing more health professionals or figuring out ways to alleviate the shortage. Because one way of getting more nurses here is to pay them much more than other jurisdictions. But other jurisdictions can retaliate. So perhaps the best way is to grow our own supply. And once people are established in the province, once the moment that they have kids in the province, as they say, that's when you can lock them in and tax them. Just kidding.
David?
Yeah, I think I'd like to see more national cooperation on that, as opposed to Alberta just offers 20,000 more, so everybody goes there, or Ontario. And now Quebec has raised their rates in recent years, and a bunch of doctors that came here from Quebec actually moved back to Quebec because the wages have gone up again. So I think I'd like to see a little more national collaboration on that. How do you set wages in the public sector? This is one of the fundamental challenges. In the private sector, it's not clean, but it does sort of tie to profitability. It does tie to competitors. It ties to a lot of factors. But what about in the public sector? So it is, you need to drive up, as Richard has said, you need to drive up supply. You certainly don't want shortages. The minute you get shortages, that's when you're going to get big spikes in wage costs. And you want your nurses and your doctors and your other healthcare workers to be paid well, but paid well should be based on benchmarks. How are they paid in other countries? How are they paid in other provinces? How are they paid relative to other segments of the economy? So you can't just unmoor those. Like if a doctor's wage relative to the overall wage has gone from 300% to 450%, that should be a bit of a red flag. And so we need to have, I think, a better conversation about how that happens. But it does start with supply and making sure you've got enough supply. And then salary should be set based on best practices, based on how it's done elsewhere. And then if you had a little bit better interprovincial cooperation, you wouldn't get this sort of, well, Nova Scotia needs more nurses, so we're going to plop on a $20,000 signage fee and try to scrape a bunch away from New Brunswick. That has happened and does happen, happens every year. It's not necessarily good for the system as a whole.
I don't know how we'd do that, but if we could figure out a way to tie extra federal assistance to wage control mechanisms, that would be a good idea, because as I said, the cost escalation in terms of wages is, and when people say, I deserve this salary, everyone deserves a great salary. We're not saying that people are overpaid. There's no morality associated with public sector wages. It's just a matter of what kind of rent you can extract, what kind of strategy you can follow. When Paul Martin announced in 2004, I believe, a fix for a generation, and announced that he would be growing healthcare spending by 6% annually, what do you think stakeholders take as a message in that? That funding for healthcare is growing at 6% annually. What do you think they ask in terms of annual increases? You know, when you know the money's out there, you'd be dumb not to go get it. You can't blame people for being rational.
Okay.
That takes us into the 1042 conversation.
Yeah, well, we have to move on from the subject, but I will say one last thing. When I graduated from a university in Virginia and I went to a session for public sector jobs, and there was a public sector, I think it was federal government recruiter. He stood up at the front of the room and he said right out of the gate, first thing he said was, you will earn significantly less money if you work in the public sector. This was Virginia. But you will have the knowledge that you're doing the public's work, you're doing good work for your community, et cetera, and we have a great pension and benefit system. That's what he said. I got back to Canada, and lo and behold, this is, you know, young 20-something-year-old David. Turns out the public sector here, actually, on average, you get paid considerably more if you're a secretary in the public sector versus the private sector. So I don't have a problem with professionals being paid a good salary, but you do have to have logic to it. It does have to be tied to some sort of reality. And again, in the public sector, if that reality is just as much rent as you can squeeze out of the system, to use Richard's term, it's not necessarily the most effective way to set public policy. I was just talking yesterday about this 10-day sick day policy, this idea that everybody should have 10 sick days. So I went in and looked at it. In fact, the average New Brunswicker already takes 10 days, but the public sector, it's much higher, 13 and a half days in the public sector on average. So, and then I find out, which is true, that in the public sector, they're not actually sick days, they're other vacation days. So you can basically take them for any reason, whether you're sick or not. So why use the euphemism? Why call it a sick day? Why not just say we're going to give people 10 or 12 or 15 days to do whatever they want? Because if you can bank them and if you get other benefit from them, they're not really sick days. So I love the concept of sick days so that people that are really sick don't lose their income. Not as happy with, you know, piling on 15 days of sick on top of 4 weeks of vacation on top of 15 stat holidays, and you end up with a worker that gets 45 to 50 days off every year, and you end up basically with a four-day work week. So anyway, not to rant, although we do a little ranting on this show, Matt, but I think you have to have best practices. You have to have logic when you're talking about things like salaries in the public sector.
Well, David, you teed this one up, and this question comes from Inda. And Inda actually writes for Huddle. It's great to have Huddle in the audience for the webinar. Inda asks, we've heard some debate about boosting the minimum wage to $15 an hour, but that's generally opposed by businesses. Just recently, Chambers of Commerce in New Brunswick also oppose the 10-day paid sick days proposed by Trudeau. If implementing such policies are difficult for the private sector, what can be done to help them?
My short answer to that is that there's a whole suite of tools that we need to look at when we're considering what is called a living wage. The minimum wage is one way. Problem with minimum wage is that if it's set at a rate that is actually effective, it will result in fewer jobs. So it's much smarter, in my view, to have perhaps looking at wage subsidies, forms of complementarity, trying to tie that into some sort of logic of basic annual income, or to look at other ways that we help out people. So we can help with rent, we can help with to make life more affordable for those who earn less money. So rather than just talking about minimum wage, every time people go to minimum wage, what they're talking about is a living, affordable lifestyle, a way to make ends meet. So let's And not every time someone says, what do you think of a $15 minimum wage? Say, well, sure, but let's discuss the broader issue of making sure that people can live an affordable life.
Yeah, I mean, Richard's right. It's what problem are you trying to solve? So I saw a study, this was way back a while ago, but I think it was around 65% of everybody working at the minimum wage was a student. So are you trying to raise the wage of students, or is your real focus adults that are at the minimum wage that are living in poverty? And if so, what problem are you trying to solve, both with the 10 sick days and with minimum wage discussions? And if you know what problem you're trying to solve, there may be other tools to do that, such as basic income, such as wage subsidies, such as, I'm a bit of a fan of the negative income tax that they have in the US. If you, at the end of the year, if you don't earn enough inning, you get money back, even if you didn't pay any income tax, to make sure you're at a threshold, right? So I think there's other ways to do it. I'm not sure that giving my teenage children, you know, a big raise, a 40% raise in their salary, solves the problem you're actually trying to solve.
I know this is high on the minds of young people, though. I mean, when I look at my parents' generation, two entry-level positions equaled a house and two cars in the garage, but now it just doesn't. And I don't know what the problem is, whether that's the CPI or whatever it is. So, but I know young people are really serious about this idea of being paid fair wages for fair work.
And most economists will agree with this importance, but do you care about what appears on your paycheck, or do you care about how much, like, from who that comes from the government or from the employer, or do you care about your employer actually giving you $15? Because when you're looking at the minimum wage, particularly for young people, if it is effective, it will mean fewer jobs for younger people. And there are ways to actually circumvent that problem by supplementing income in a way that is not distorting the market incentive, so that as many jobs remain in the economy, so that you don't have, because it's a bit of this is a bit of the insider's problem. In France, they have a big problem with that, is that once you're into the system and benefiting from the rent, you're okay. But in order to achieve that, you have to exclude others. And that's the part that is not fun, because these are the poor people who can't find a job. So if it is to be effective, as I said, it needs to be high enough, or else it's just there for show. So rather than using such a blunt instrument, let's have a conversation about the working poor.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, back to the audience. Sebastian, hello, Sebastian. How can immigration contribute to a new normal, Richard?
I'm almost inclined to leave that one to David, because David is probably the most aggressive person on immigration that I know. And if you don't mind, I'll put you on the spot, David, and ask you to answer that one first.
So I think we have to think very short term. So I was talking to folks on Prince Edward Island this week, and they're actually going to see a big decline this year after many, many years of very solid immigration. And their message to the public is, look, we might have a little bit of a high unemployment situation now in targeted sectors, so maybe we don't need the flow this year specifically. But next year and the next year, we're going to get right back into it, because high levels of immigration are the number one reason why PEI has boomed relative to the other three Atlantic provinces since 2010. And they get it. The median age on PEI has been declining in recent years. PEI is getting younger. So let that sink in to everybody that's been told we're getting older, we're getting older, we're getting older. PEI is actually getting younger. And we're actually heading in that direction with our increase in recent years in international migration and the retention of international migrants. So I think immigration is going to be a key part of the solution. It's going to help enrich our communities. It's going to enrich our labor markets. And people that are coming are building their careers here. They're bringing young families in many cases. If you look at our, and we'll be talking about this on the Turning Point related to labor markets, but most of the immigrants coming now are actually bringing young children with them, which means they're going to be in the workforce faster than if they were 20-year-olds and not ready to have family yet, right? So there's double benefits there. The workers are coming in and they're bringing children that are going to be in the workforce within 10 years or so on average. So I think it's all good for the most part. I mean, we have to talk to New Brunswickers. We have to have a conversation about why, but we've seen recent polling numbers that confirm the fact that most New Brunswickers think if we have vacant jobs in professional and non-professional jobs, that it's great to bring in immigrants to fill those jobs. So I'm very excited about international migration, about bringing people in here to help enrich our communities. And I think it's going to be, I don't see a downside to it. If some come and they're not gainfully employed or they struggle, they will migrate to other areas in Canada. But the numbers are so small that it's a rounding error, you know, if a few of them move to Toronto or Montreal or elsewhere in the country.
Richard, will you leave it at that, or do you want to contribute some more?
Oh, I was just thinking about the comment the premier made about immigrants from India who have found land in Buktush, and they said the conditions here are perfect for growing apples, and their objective is to be the largest growers of apples, I think, by 2025. So it gives you an example that immigration is also a source of entrepreneurship.
But it needs to be more so. So yeah. Historically, over the last 10, 12, 13 years, most of the immigrant entrepreneurs have focused on service industries. They've set up restaurants and, you know, small local shops. We need more of that type of entrepreneur coming in and making million-dollar investments in export-focused sectors. And that's really exciting, because then you start to see a new round. And a few years ago, I did an analysis of the top entrepreneurs in British Columbia. So the top fastest growing companies in British Columbia, and the majority of them were immigrant owned. So this is an exciting opportunity to bring in entrepreneurial folks with capital that are going to invest in our province, build a great new generation of entrepreneurs, in many cases in conjunction with local entrepreneurs as they partner up. And I think it's a really exciting opportunity as well.
David, it ties with something that is dear to your heart, David, which is it doesn't matter what sector you're in. If you can find growth in New Brunswick, let's not spit on it and make sure that we grow regardless of the industry.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of, sorry, Matt, but there is a lot of, a little bit of elitism anyway in some of the economic development planning and government circles that say, well, we don't want these low-end jobs. We don't want chicken processing jobs and truckers. Who cares? But then when you look at the income data, the number of people in Ontario, in Toronto specifically, earning less than $35,000 a year has gone up significantly in the last 10 years, while it's declined significantly in New Brunswick. So the reality is, in any labor market, you have lots of people working at various levels in the income scale. And the minute you say we're not interested, the risk is that you become Northern Canada and Moncton becomes, you know, Nunavut and St. John becomes Yellowknife, where wages are extremely high and the only work that's being done there is work that absolutely has to be done there. And that's not really a vision. If that's our vision of the future, is that Atlantic Canada is going to become Northern Canada in terms of wage levels and cost structures, I don't think that's a very positive vision. So we need to make sure there's enough labor to fill the demand wherever it is. Now, we need to work significantly on productivity. That's one of the key messages Richard makes, and he's right. If we can do something with five workers that used to be done with 10, and those five get paid significantly more, that they get some of the benefits of those gains along with the entrepreneur, that's a win-win. The company's more productive, the exporter's more productive, and the employees are making more money. So labor productivity and overall multi-factor productivity is very, very important. But it's not a substitute for ensuring you've got enough workers to work in the industries where there's demand right now and where there will be demand in 5 years and in 10 years. And Matt, you've turned this into a rant session. I don't know if that makes sense or not. But
well, I'm just sitting here enjoying and picturing Herb's rants next week. I guarantee we'll have some. Dave, you seem to be channeling the audience here because you're hitting on things that they're asking us. One final audience question, guys, and then we'll get into a couple quick segments and then we'll wrap up. Keith. Hello, Keith. Keith says, we are a hub province. For those of us exporting goods and products, it's all about the NB border. How do we best support exporters during COVID-19 and after?
Outstanding question. We're doing... I really don't want to be negative on people right now. We're learning as we go on this one. I need to commend the premier for having backtracked on the issue of temporary foreign workers. It's not easy to do things like those, and I really, you know, you can't, you know, hindsight is 20/20 on this one. And I hope that with openness that we're going to make sure that we have the proper framework in place. But so far, I think that we're learning as we go and that, you know, I give the authorities a very good note. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's important to note that the international border and the national border are still open for trade, for truck traffic, right? So this is, it's been closed mostly for individuals, but they're still letting in our avocados and our bananas and our, you know, meat products. So I think there's still a lot of trade happening. We are seeing quite a bit of softness in the export data right now, particularly around stuff that's not urgent. But you know, we are still an export focused province. I worry about services exports. A lot of the folks work in New Brunswick working for, say, WestJet or Air Canada or any of the hotels like Wyndham and St. John. I suspect most of them are furloughed right now because there's not a lot of people booking hotel rooms. So I get a little worried about our services exports, but I think we need to recommit to the importance of our export sector. It was worth $23 billion interprovincial and international combined in 2016. It's an incredibly important part of our economy and our future.
David, you're right to be worried about the call centers industry. I was looking at the data from StatsCan, and it's the second sector in New Brunswick that was hit the most by the COVID crisis after travel and hospitality, restaurants and hospitality. And it was hit much more than in Canada as a whole. So you're right that a lot of those people have been furloughed.
And the challenge is, because many of those jobs are moving to home-based or moving virtual. They don't have to be in New Brunswick anymore. So unless we have the pool of labor here over time, and Marriott had used to have a very large center here. They went virtual, and most of those jobs are now out of the province, at least I'm told. So that's the risk in the long run, that you used to have this really dynamic business services sector bringing in $1.4 billion a year in export revenue, and that whittles away over time because it's easier to find workers in Mississauga or in Calgary for those jobs than it is in New Brunswick. And if that happens, that would be a shame. And that's another reason why we need to be focused on ensuring we have a good inward flow of individuals from across Canada and around the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, let's wrap it up here. Richard, we have two final segments. These are just for you. David gets his time in the limelight in a couple weeks. We're going to play Overrated, Underrated. Herb, if you're listening, I know you're very excited to play this game. That's your favorite podcast game, so we will with you as well. Richard, Overrated, Underrated. Urbanization in the province, the urbanization movement, overrated or underrated?
In the way it's being framed, overrated.
Okay. Tell us about one New Brunswick turning point. This can be in the past or one that you can foresee in the future.
Well, in the past, obviously, equal opportunities for all in the 1960s is unavoidable. In the future, well, in the recent past, the immigration uptick, I didn't think that it would be, the response would be that great. And my heart is warmed. I'm heartened by that.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. You've been very gracious. Richard, it was a pleasure to speak with you on the webinar and then get to take it over here into the virtual studio on the Growing Pains podcast. I encourage everyone to go to turningpointnb.ca, register for the webinars next week, whether in English or in French. I believe, Richard, you'll be there on the French side next week. And on the English side, we're starting with Jean-Guy Finn and Herb Emery. Thank you very much for our listeners and their questions. We're happy to have you, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.